although we've come a long way in recent years in both understanding and treating those with mental health problems, we're still a far way off from dealing with the issue sufficiently. Thousands of people across the country are dealing with mental health problems every single day. However, they're not seeking help. Those same people, if they had heart disease or some other physical condition, would be straight down to the doctor. But statistics have shown that depression, on average, is 50% more disabling than angina, asthma, arthritis or diabetes. That's a pretty shocking statistic, and one that should wake us up to the need to deal with mental health issues immediately. But what's the correct treatment for mental health problems? I mean, after all, there are different ways of treating physical conditions, so how should we determine what's best to deal with depression or anxiety disorders? And is there anything that could be done to prevent mental health problems developing in the first place? In the same way, say, that, you know, we know we shouldn't smoke, or we should limit alcohol, we should avoid junk food, all that kind of stuff. Well, Richard Layard and David M. Clark have written a book that addresses these questions. It's called Thrive, The Power of Evidence-Based Psychological Therapies, and David joins me now. David, thank you very much indeed for being with us on the programme this morning. First of all, David, give me some background info on both yourself and Richard and explain why you are both so involved in this issue.
Well, I'm a professor of clinical psychology at Oxford, and my work involves trying to develop new and more effective psychological treatments for a range of different anxiety problems. Richard Layard is an economist who has spent much of his life looking at economic factors which undermine people's well-being. Initially, he was looking at unemployment, but he discovered from some of his research that actually the thing which determines well-being more than anything else is whether or not you have a mental health problem. And so he now spends a lot of time trying to put forward the economic argument for why we should be much more thorough in treating mental health problems.
Okay, well, this book is called Thrive, The Power of Evidence-Based Psychological Therapies. So basically the crux of the problem, as far as you're concerned, is that physical pain is treated automatically by our medical services, mental pain is not, and that leads to a whole host of issues for individuals and society in general.
Yes, that's right. Only about 30% of people with mental health problems get any form of treatment, whereas if you had cancer or cardiovascular disease, it would be 90-95%, and there would be a national scandal if it was anything less than that. The extraordinary thing, though, of course, is that we now have treatments for mental health problems which can be very effective, and not only are they effective, but they essentially pay for themselves. So the cost of a course of evidence-based psychological therapy on average is, say, £600 to £900, but the saving just to the economy of getting someone better is many thousands of pounds. So this is a sort of no-brainer, really.
Because an awful lot of it remains hidden, the general public really don't have much of an idea of the extent of the problem, do they?
Yeah, that's right. So around one in six people in the community are suffering from depression or anxiety problems. But, of course, they often don't talk about them. They often feel ashamed by it. And also, another bit of the stigma is that people don't realize that there really are treatments that are effective. So they think, well, what's the point of talking about it if, you know, it's not going to go away? But things have changed dramatically in the last couple of decades. There have been big advances in the treatments that are available. And now a large number of people have a realistic chance, if they go through a course of therapy, of fully recovering and staying well.
And would you say that we all have a job to do? For instance, use the word stigma there. Would you say that a victim's stigma is our prejudice?
Yes, very much so. I mean, there's very broad misunderstanding of mental health problems. That anyone can develop them, given the right circumstances, is one of the things that people don't appreciate. Another one, of course, is that they are very treatable. And the more people talk about it, the more we'll normalize this experience in the same way that we have done for cancer, for example, where, you know, there was a stigma about talking about that. There isn't now.
OK, so the courage of sufferers to talk in public, like, it's fantastic. That really is a great help for everybody else. But some of the statistics you have, like one in three families have someone with mental illness, or 9 out of 10 prisoners have mental problems in terms of our jails, etc. When we think of mental illness, we often only think about the impact it has on the person concerned and maybe their immediate family as well. But in your book, you highlight the impact it has on society and our economies too.
Yes, that's right. I mean, in terms of our economies, about 40% of all absenteeism at work is to do with mental health problems. About half of the people on incapacity benefits, state benefits, is to do with mental health problems. So those are enormous costs in terms of the state system and productivity. But in terms of the family, of course, someone who is depressed or anxious is often not really in the moment. They're lost in their own thoughts and ruminations and things. And so they can have much less of a sort of role in looking after their children, in interacting with the rest of the family. And so the rest of the family suffer as well.
So when we look at all the headings under mental illness, depression, is anxiety disorder, is that depression?
No, it's a separate series of problems. Many people are depressed and anxious, but classic examples of an anxiety disorder would be, say, agoraphobia, yeah. Where people are very afraid to go out of their own home because they're worried they'll have attacks of anxiety. Post-traumatic stress disorder, where people have experienced terrible things, assaults, rape, seeing terrorist acts and things like that, and they're haunted by memories of those, and they can't get them out of their mind. Another common anxiety disorder is social anxiety disorder, where people are extremely anxious about meeting other people and talking to them. Mm. And that is incredibly disabling, actually, from even early in childhood. So many people develop the problem in late childhood or adolescence, and they actually feel so self-conscious in the classroom that they can't concentrate on what the teacher's saying. And so, of course, they get much less good exam results than they'd expect, given their intelligence, and that blights the rest of their life. But it's a very treatable condition.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second, but I just want to look at some more of the sort of the facts and figures and just what it's all about. Like, do mentally ill patients get more physical ailments and respond worse to treatment?
Yes, so they have a much increased risk of a range of different physical ailments. And also, if they've got a long-term physical problem like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obstructive airways disease, they respond less well to the physical treatments. And the physical treatments cost more money to deliver. If you treat the depression, then you make vast savings in terms of treatment of the physical condition, and it's more effective.
Okay,
so for example, someone with diabetes and depression, they often have very poor control of their diabetes. But if you treat the depression, you can vastly improve the control of the diabetes as well.
Okay, so domino effect in terms of just the good it can have for the individual, the family, and the whole of society.
Very much so.
Okay, let's take a look at like physical illness, poverty, unemployment. They all cause suffering in our society. You would maintain that mental illness causes a lot more.
Yes, and there's really quite good data on that. If you look at the sort of best predictors of people's sense of well-being, mental illness predicts much more than employment or poverty and physical health problems as well.
Okay, let's just take a look at one thing then, suicide. Would you, contend that the vast majority of people who kill themselves have some form of a mental illness?
That is correct, yes.
That's correct in terms of the evidence and the statistics, is it?
Yes.
Okay, and what about, there is one like murder and warfare. They cause an awful lot of deaths, obviously, but more people die of their own hand than those two put together.
Well, it does depend a bit where you're living at the moment.
Well, that's true as well, of course, yeah.
If you're living in Iraq or Syria, it might be the other way around. But in countries which have a much more situation like ours, that's true.
And where we live, is youth suicide on the rise, and do twice as many men as women commit suicide?
It depends very much on your age, actually, for the difference in suicide. So for men, the difference favours men rather than women when you get to the middle age groups, where the sort of in middle age, it's really the men who are the big risks.
Okay, well then let's cross the bridge and go to the next part, because the majority of people who need help, as I said at the beginning, they do not get treatment. That's a fact, is it?
That's right, yes. Only about a third do.
Wow, okay.
And many of them don't get appropriate treatment.
Right, okay, even if they do. Okay, so mental illness causes misery and injustice, so does Thrive, the book. Are you explaining new and effective solutions or approaches?
Yeah, so we're saying that there are sort of two general approaches that you could have for treating mental health problems. One is drugs, particularly antidepressants, and we have a range of them, and they've been around for the last 30 years or so. There haven't been any new developments in that area. But it's certainly the case that quite a number of people find them helpful. But many people would prefer not to take a drug or don't benefit from it. And so then the alternative approach is psychological treatment. And that's where the big changes have happened in the last couple of decades. There have been really big advances in developing very specialized forms of psychological treatments, which really very precisely target the sort of main things that are keeping different mental health problems going. And if you do surveys of the general public and ask, you know, what would you prefer, an evidence-based psychological therapy or a drug treatment, in a very consistently, in a ratio of about 3-1, people say, I'd like the psychological therapy. But that's not what people are getting. The vast majority of people who get any treatment are getting drug treatments.
Okay, so what is the psychological? Are we talking about cognitive behavioral therapy, as in like mental hygiene? And is it better than taking drugs?
So there are a range of them. It depends on the mental health condition. The one that's most extensively researched and has the sort of widest evidence base is cognitive behavior therapy. But it's not the only one, actually. There's also good evidence for some people that couples therapy, if you're depressed in the context of a relationship, is helpful. There's also some evidence for therapy called interpersonal psychotherapy. And some of the more traditional psychodynamic treatments in some conditions are also helpful. So there's a range of treatments that can be offered. The key thing is that research has really defined which conditions each of these treatments work for, so we can be very precise in targeting them.
Okay, well, these treatments, these therapies that you talk about, what are we talking about here? To get back to something I vaguely might have mentioned earlier on, are we talking about management rather than cure?
For some people, that is true, that they learn techniques for managing what seems to be a chronic problem. But I think the big change is for people to realize that in many cases, we are talking much more like cure. So for anxiety and depression, it's perfectly realistic to see that at least half of the people with these conditions will completely recover from them with a course of cognitive behavior therapy. For the remaining people, many of them will have still got worthwhile benefits. That's in the short term. But a lot of the strength of the psychological treatments is in the longer term. So if you are experiencing depression and have drug treatment and antidepressant and recover, that's great news, but it doesn't change your future risk of having another episode of depression. And most people find that depression is a recurrent problem. If you've had one episode, you have a very high chance of having another one later in your life. The psychological treatments essentially halve that risk. So that's a very important finding. And the reason they halve that risk is they teach people some new skills and ways of managing the sort of adversity that they're likely to experience. Because, of course, most people get depressed in the context of things going wrong in their life. Yeah. But it gives people new ways of approaching those difficult periods in their life. And so that's really why NICE, that's the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, tends to now recommend psychological treatments as the first choice option, because it has that possibility of really sustained benefit.
Okay, well then when we talk about mental illness and anxiety disorder and depression, etc., you would see it most definitely as the key health issue of our day. If we have a minister for health, are you saying it's important to have a minister for mental health?
Yes, that's an extremely good point. It seems crazy to us that we don't have a minister specifically for mental health. We should have someone in the cabinet who is specifically responsible for mental health.
And what is it? Is it the stigma that makes people say they don't really want to talk about it? And the more people that do, the more people are, and the more we realise just how big the problem is. And it's a good thing that people talk.
It's an extremely good thing that people talk. And the more transparency we can have, the better. Transparency in terms of mental health services reporting their outcomes. So, I mean, I think you might be staggered to hear this, but only, you know, 10 years ago, there was a survey of UK psychiatrists, and they were asked, you know, do you ever give a sort of objective measure of the severity of someone's depression when treating it? And only 11% of them were doing that. Now, if we thought about GPs treating high blood pressure, and only 11% of them said we ever bother to measure blood pressure, we'd be scandalized. But that was the position we were in in mental health. But things have really radically changed now, particularly in a program called the Improving Access to Psychological Therapies Initiative, which is a sort of English initiative at the moment. Everyone who is having a psychological therapy gets a sort of objective measure of how depressed or how anxious they are each time they're seen. And so now it's possible to see, you know, exactly how much everyone is improving. And that data is put in the public domain. So the NHS Information Centre publishes the data in terms of recovery rates for different psychological therapy services throughout the country. And any member of the public could, you know, log onto the website and look at that. And that is really a revolution. It's moving us out of the dark ages. People with mental health problems can, you know, ask legitimate questions like, you know, is my local service good enough? Is it getting the sort of recovery rates that we'd expect elsewhere? People for physical health problems have been able to look at this for a long time. They've been able to look at, you know, what the long-term outcomes are of people going through radiotherapy, chemotherapy, and things like that. People with mental health problems have never been had access to that information, but that is changing. And it, of course, changes people's way of thinking about mental health when you give them that information, because they now realize, oh, yeah, there is a real chance of things improving.
So there is a real chance of things improving. You look at the cognitive behavioural therapy, which, as you say, is not necessarily for everybody. I mean, a lot of people don't like to talk. They don't want to be doing homework or writing in journals every time they have a feeling. So, you know, you're not necessarily dismissing drugs or anything like that necessarily. But the whole issue now, and people, the way they look at it, and the fact that so many doors have opened, are you saying it's kind of more than a key to mental illness? It's a key to a happy life?
Yes, very much so. Because, of course, If you're changing the way people deal with adversity in the long term, then, of course, that allows them to have a much happier life. And you really do transform people's lives dramatically. I mean, if we take the condition I talked about earlier on, social anxiety disorder, where, you know, people are leaving school early without qualifications because they can't stand being in the classroom. But if you treat it, then, of course, a whole new life opens up. And one of the really stunning things about the treatment of the anxiety disorders is that, you know, people have followed people up sort of 5 years or 10 years after the end of the treatment trials, and people are maintaining their gains. So if you think about treating someone in late adolescence or in their 20s for social anxiety, average life expectancy now takes us to over 80. So this sort of short course of treatment is going to change the person's life for the next 60 years. Yeah, think of all the different opportunities that they'll have, the different people they can meet, and the different ways in which they can develop once they're freed from that anxiety.
Of course. Well, then on that level, as you mentioned that, in terms of all those years, I mean, schools, should it be part of the whole edict of what a school might be? Should they have an explicit objective, if you like, that stuff should be more about collaboration, less about competition?
Yes. Richard and I, in the book, argue quite strongly for that. We think it's really crazy at the moment that schools spend almost no time teaching people how to recognize and deal with emotions, as though, you know, the rest of their life is going to be a non-emotional state.
Yeah.
It would make enormous sense for schools to pay more attention to this.
And what about society itself? I mean, is there a problem there in terms of the fact that an enemy of what you would like to happen is the whole sort of emphasis on being so macho?
Yeah, so I think there is an argument for saying that the sort of very intense competitiveness that we have at the moment in society can really undermine people's productivity and as well as their well-being. And so we would like a shift to a somewhat less macho, less aggressive culture.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, the book is called Thrive, The Power of Evidence-Based Psychological Therapies, and it is David M. Clark, one of the, and you mentioned your colleague as well, Richard Laird. Just one last thing I want to mention this, obviously, David, like, can we prevent mental illness?
As I said, there's good evidence that you can prevent new episodes of depression for someone who's already had it, so that's straightforward. There is also some evidence, actually, that you can prevent a first episode. So there are some studies that have been done with people, say, in their first year as undergraduates in university, a very stressful time in their lives, and you take them and you put them through a preventative sort of psychological program, and you reduce the chance that they'll have a first episode of depression.
And have you been reading over the last few days since Robin Williams' death in terms of just what's in the papers and how medical journals, or stuff that you might only find in the medical journal, is now in all the kind of broadsheets and the papers and that? Have you looked at it and seen that, wait a minute, these people don't know what they're talking about, or this is good that it's out in the open, or it's good that people are you know, mentioning it?
Well, I think the press coverage has been rather mixed. I mean, it's very good that it's highlighted the significance of mental health problems. I think some people who've been talking about it have suggested that there isn't that much in the way of effective treatments because, you know, he sadly ended up killing himself and he had been in contact with some treatment services. But that really isn't correct. I mean, the hope for people has changed dramatically. It is true that not everyone gets channeled into the right treatment, and we need governments to really take that point seriously and have a routine system in every area of the country which gets people to be properly assessed and have free treatment on a health service.
Okay, well, David, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Thrive, the Power of Evidence-Based Psychological Therapies is what it's called, and it is from Richard Layard and David M. Clark. David, thank you very much for talking to us.
Okay.